Today on Annenberg Radio News.
So we're just like one big happy family out here. And if you want to be our family, you got to come out here and walk for a couple of weeks, and then we'd like to get in the family.
A community of walkers come together every morning at Rancho Cienega Park to exercise and foster friendships. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, April 26th, 2012. I'm Benjamin Gottlieb. USC is ramping up security around the university in the wake of the fatal shooting of two graduate students from China earlier this month. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa joined USC President Max Nikias and Police Chief Charlie Beck today to announce the new safety measures. Our Lucas Alexander has a story.
Whenever young, innocent kids are brutally attacked in the way that they were, you have to say, no, not in my city, not in our city.
Mayor Villaraigosa passed along this message to members of the USC community at USC's Town and Gown Ballroom this morning.
What happened a few weeks ago was something that not only affected the student body, but it tore at the heartstrings of Angelenos all across the city.
So as Police Chief Charlie Beck outlined, many safety adjustments are being made around the USC community, and it is all coming out of President Nikias' pocket. To begin with, 30 police officers will be permanently added to the Southwest Division, which patrols the area around USC, and four of these newly added officers will strictly monitor the area directly surrounding USC.
Their task will be to make sure that those surrounding and adjoining residential areas of SC where so many students live are safe.
And although violence has decreased in the USC area by 27% over the last 2 years, Police Chief Beck is confident that these safety measures are a necessary precaution.
This is an awful, singular incident. But this is not the trend in the SC area. You know, this is not us trying to catch up. This is us addressing an awful, singular incident.
Additionally, a detective and city attorney will be assigned to focus wholly on the USC area. And finally, Police Chief Beck was asked about the ongoing investigation.
I'm pleased with the progress to date. You know, I won't predict when we will give you an outcome, but I am confident in the detectives. I'm confident in the investigative process that's going forward. We will reach a resolution on this.
No new information has been released. Lucas Alexander, Annenberg Radio News.
Today marks the 2-month anniversary of the shooting of Trayvon Martin. The Florida teenager was killed in Sanford, Florida by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch commander who says he shot Martin in self-defense. Martin's family, basketball legend Magic Johnson, and the Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are all gathering this evening on Crenshaw Boulevard for a rally. Reporter Conrad Wilton is on the scene at the West Los Angeles Church of Christ, where preparations for the rally are underway. Conrad, what can we expect at tonight's rally?
Thank you, Ben. I would say that I've been talking to a couple people around here, and tonight's rally, they expect to fill all 5,000 seats in the West Angeles Church here, and a lot of people are calling it one of the biggest events that this church will host in its history because of the national relevance of Martin's death, and also the fact, of course, that Martin's mom and dad and a whole other list of people are coming to speak about racial justice and also social justice here at the church.
Now, Conrad, what's the mood of the crowd right now?
I would say there isn't all that much of a crowd. The event starts at 5:30, so it's still pretty early, but from what I've seen, the people who are walking in, they're dressed fairly formally. It's an evening affair, and they seem somber. They seem as if rather silent. They're not saying all that much. They're walking in rather peacefully, but again, kind of early to tell how things are going to shape up, but it should be a momentum-filled affair, to say the least.
And any indication what the reverends will be talking about tonight?
I can tell you that I know that the reverends will probably be discussing not just Trayvon Martin. That's one of the things. I was actually just speaking to a nice lady here, and she was saying that this is not just about Trayvon Martin. That's sort of how they're doing it. But it's also about racial profiling on a national scale. There are some people here who are upset about the death of Kendry McVade, who was the Pasadena teen who was shot by police. And it's about a whole national issue. So it's going to be general and broad, and that's about as much as I can see right now.
Well, Conrad, thank you so much for checking in. That was Conrad Wilton over in at the West Los Angeles Church of Christ, where preparations are underway for a rally for Trayvon Martin. This week marks the 20th anniversary of the infamous 1992 Los Angeles riots. And in honor of the anniversary, community activists and scholars met at USC today to talk about the lessons learned and those that weren't. Melissa Runnels reports.
Labor and community organizers from all over town gathered for a conference today at USC. The conference, called From the Ashes, the 1992 Civil Unrest and the Rise of Social Movement Organizing, is less about what happened then and more about what we can do now and in the future to make things better. And the organizers do feel there's a lot that needs to get better. With anti-labor rhetoric on the rise, an increasing divide between rich and poor, increasing use of surveillance in the wake of 9/11, these are all big concerns. And with the deaths of Kendrick McDade and Trayvon Martin in the news, concerns about the nexus of race, law enforcement, and violence are also high on the list. Eric Mann of the Labor Community Strategy Center was one of the keynote speakers.
There is no black man, apparently, who is not suspicious in U.S. society. And there are so many people in this room who could tell you heartbreaking stories of living while black. Is I think one thing that's very important is to keep the story going in all its specificity, right?
Danny Park has been organizing labor in Koreatown for over two decades and was there at the riots. He said the level of communication within the Korean community and between Korean Americans and other groups had to get better, and it did.
It was a huge wake-up call for everyone, and I think that really did start a lot of organizing effort and, rebuilding.
Where all that effort goes depends a lot on younger people like Kevin Cosney, who attended the conference. Cosney's 25, and he was growing up in Simi Valley when the trials of the policeman charged with the beating of Rodney King were held. He remembers a vivid contrast between the atmosphere in Simi Valley and the wildness that flamed up in L.A.
I remember seeing the city where I was at just kind of on lock before they even released the results from the trial and things like that.
Although he was only 5 years old at the time, Kevin was struck by the images of what he describes as violence and bodies of color. And he says as a black man, his life has not been free of that violence, for instance.
In all the times where I've really been harassed by police, I've really been in innocence. Coming out of a movie theater, my friend fit a description. I'm like, we just got out the movie theater, right? I'm not talking to you, and just don't. You know, that's when I got thrown up against the car. There's been instances where I've just been out.
That's why he's working with California Calls, a community activist group, and why he was at the conference today.
You know, there's been times where I've felt anger, but I also understand that anger doesn't change anything, and so it's how do you funnel that anger into something. And I think that's where the passion I have for the work that I do comes from.
And that's what the conference wants to achieve, to keep these kinds of conversations going and to channel that anger and the memory of the riots into positive action. For Annenberg Radio News, I'm Melissa Runnels.
The so-called subway to the sea is inching its way to the coast. The Metropolitan Transit Authority Board of Directors today approved a plan to expand the West Side Metro subway by 9 miles. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and the MTA want the expansion to begin as soon as possible. But as Nick Edmonds reports, nearby neighborhoods are weighing the pros and cons of such a major project.
The L.A. County Metro Transportation Authority Board of Directors voted 11-1 today on a motion headed by Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. The mayor's motion looked to certify an environmental impact report regarding the West Side subway extension. The plan involves a 9-mile extension from the Wilshire Western Station to Westwood VA Hospital, which could get riders from Westwood to downtown in just 25 minutes. People like Ann Wynn of the Central City Association believe this extension has been a long time coming.
Businesses and residents on the West Side have long waited for dependable alternatives to transportation other than the use of a car, and this project responds to that call.
Supporters of the extension say building 7 new subway stops will add jobs to the economy. However, there were dozens in attendance imploring the board to wait for the data, which would show the dangers of their current plan. PTA President at Hawthorne Elementary, Michelle Rose.
We understand that there's jobs involved. We want those jobs, but we want safety for those workers as well as safety for our children. And going underneath the high school where we aren't sure what's under there, there's oil saturation, there's methane gas pockets. They get in there and start working, and we have a collapse or a problem. It affects not just the workers, but our school, our building, and our children.
Some believe that the board of directors is rushing the expansion process without fully checking all the safety risks involved with putting subway tunnels under schools. The mayor assured skeptics that all necessary precautions would be taken on the project.
We take the issue of safety very seriously, and particularly safety for children. Safety, without question, will be one very important consideration.
After the vote today, the MTA Board of Directors will meet in May to request approval to begin initial construction. Nick Edmonds, Annenberg Radio News.
A clinic for child abuse victims at the L.A. County USC Medical Center celebrated its grand opening today with art, music, and a standing ovation. Our Rosalie Murphy has the story.
A dozen vivid paintings of flowers, saxophones, and birds line the baby blue back wall of the Keck Medical Center of USC's newest clinic. They're all at least 3 feet long and lit in recess, and the high, drafty ceiling and glass doors ring with jazz music and friendly conversation. It almost looks like a gallery, but it's the new site of the Los Angeles County USC Medical Center's Violence Intervention Program, a clinic for child victims of sexual and physical abuse.
It's hard to explain it to people who were never here before. This was just so ugly. I just couldn't stand the fact we had no place at this hospital and had grass.
That's Dr. Astrid Hegger, who founded the clinic in 1995 and has overseen its evolution ever since. Her program serves more than 20,000 foster children and any other victims, regardless of their ability to pay. Barely a year ago, it did so from a windowless block surrounded by asphalt. Deborah Santana, founder of women's empowerment nonprofit Do A Little, says this place feels much more welcoming, and the art makes the biggest difference.
The artwork speaks for itself, that from the community, this type of brilliant art is on these walls to bless everybody who comes in, because art heals just as medicine heals.
The paintings come from Avenue 50 Studio in Highland Park. J. Michael Walker is one of its founders.
I think what's important is that the artists be able to speak a language that communicates well to the audience. Whether they're born in the same community, whether they live in the same geographic community or not, the important thing is that there's a common language.
The program also treats victims of domestic violence and elder abuse. The new location will start taking patients again in mid-May. Rosalie Murphy, Annenberg Radio News.
And now for the weather. We're looking at mostly clear skies this evening with temperatures in the mid-50s. After today's wet weather, the sunshine will return tomorrow with temperatures flirting with 70 degrees. And that sunshine should carry us through the weekend. Highs are expected in the mid-70s on Saturday and Sunday. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we discuss what law enforcement is doing to better understand the special needs of those affected by autism. Community members are still struggling to agree on the correct term to describe what happened 20 years ago in the days following the acquittal of four policemen who brutally beat Rodney King. Esther Kang digs into the debate.
While most people and media outlets refer to the 1992 mayhem as the LA riots, others have coined alternate terms, such as civil unrest and civil rebellion, to characterize the events in a different light. So what are the various connotations behind each of these names, and which one is correct? For former LAPD Chief Bernard C. Parks, it's a simple answer.
It's a riot. That's as basic as you can get. It's a riot. Whenever you have people come out in that numbers of civil disobedience and basically begin to loot stores and people get killed and injured, I don't know how you could call it anything but a riot.
At the time, it was undeniably a riot. Immediately following the verdict, angry Angelenos set fire to buildings, exchanged gunshots, and looted stores. The week-long commotion left 53 dead, thousands injured, and more than 1,000 buildings destroyed. But Professor Leland Sato, who teaches sociology at the University of Southern California, thinks we shouldn't call it a riot. He says when considering the 1992 mayhem in retrospect, calling it a riot glosses over the serious issues that existed in those communities, and in fact still exist.
By calling the civil unrest of 1992 a riot, you're focusing on the behavior of some of the individuals, and clearly, in terms of looting, burning down businesses, there was this kind of behavior occurring. But what that ignores, though, is what were some of the root causes of the civil unrest?
According to Sato, The issues serving as the undertone of the 1992 events include
massive deindustrialization, the loss of jobs, high unemployment, and other issues such as the lack of adequate housing, the lack of adequate health care, huge problems in the educational system.
But to Dr. Anthony Samad, a renowned commentator and professor of political science and African-American studies at East Los Angeles College, the term civil unrest is a government term that tries to revise the true events in retrospect.
Riots represents a term that shows that both government and the social establishment is out of control.
Samad says he alternates between riot and rebellion to describe what happened that week.
Depending on what side of the fence you were on.
While the term riot sufficiently captures the experiences of Korean merchants who incurred the brunt of the looting and damages, the black community largely calls it a rebellion, he says.
Was an act of frustration that represented a rebellion of justice.
There we have it. Riots, civil unrest, and rebellion. But are these terms mutually exclusive? Is one more correct than the other?
I think that all the terms describe part of something that's happened, or that happened in 92.
That's Joanne Kim, the Chief Operating Officer of Community Coalition, a South LA organization.
I don't want to put too much in a name, you know, and it's a label, right? You know, it's really, to me, it's not just the name, but in how we reflect upon what happened in 92.
Kim says that's why Community Coalition prefers the term civil unrest.
If we choose to focus on the rioting and the mayhem and the opportunism, which definitely was there, then we've kind of lost the opportunity to turn this tragedy into an opportunity to actually better ourselves as a society.
In the end, whether you call it the LA riots, the civil unrest, or the rebellion of 92, what truly matters is we remember and reflect on what happened on our streets 20 years ago. Esther King, Annenberg Radio News.
The Rancho Cienega Track and Field is a place of community and friendship where walkers have been coming for decades. Devin Alshul met a close-knit community of walkers who consider themselves a big, happy family.
This may sound like what you would imagine to hear at an outdoor track, but at the Rancho Cienega Track and Field, the pace is a lot slower and the chatter is a lot louder.
There's another one. Yeah?
Another old one, too.
Hi, love.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing good. Fine.
Good.
The Rancho Cienega track was built for the 1984 Olympics. Today, it is bringing people together from all over Los Angeles. Willie Holmes started walking in 1959 after his doctor told him it would fix his knee problems.
You know, he says, all you got to do is do exercise. I said, I'm doing exercise. He said, but you ain't doing enough. And I haven't had a problem since. The older you get, you got to do more exercise than you ever done in your life than when you started getting old. But a lot of people don't understand that.
Today, Holmes, who is 81 years old, spends every morning at the track from 7 to 11. He does 1,600 steps 3 days a week and walks a mile on the others. Afterwards, you'll find him underneath the big tree in the corner, eating a healthy breakfast of bananas and pecans, and helping stretch or massage other walkers. He pointed out one man in particular who he had helped with arthritis. He helped rub out Daniel Brown's knee, who is better known as Mr. Brown at the track. He has been walking there for 10 years.
I retired on Friday, and I came out here on Monday and started walking. And I've been walking ever since.
He's been making friends like Willie Holmes since he started walking at Rancho Cienega.
Everywhere I go, I run into somebody, no matter what part of town I go in, I run into somebody here that walk. And they've changed clothes, and they don't look the same, so they come and they speak and say, oh, I walk out there. We walk.
Mr. Brown walks a mile with his cane alongside his partners, Joni Spencer and Trudy Wiggins. They walk 5 days a week, all year round. When they are done walking, they sit on the bleachers and talk about life, sports, and health food. Wiggins says they like to mingle with everyone who passes by.
We introduce ourselves. We get to know them. And so therefore, there's not too many people to walk out here that we don't know. And, I mean, we don't care who they are. So we're just like one big happy family out here. And if you want to be our family, you got to come out here and walk for a couple of weeks, and then we'd let you get in the family.
This group of seniors does not go unnoticed by other younger walkers at the track.
They have done so much for the track. They keep us motivated to keep coming. I'm 54, and I'm the little boy here.
The Rancho Cienega Track and Field is home to a very different kind of family. It's become the one permanent fixture in many of the walkers' lives.
A day without walking is a day like something's went wrong. Like the day's not complete.
Everyone at the track agrees. When they don't spend the day at the track, they spend it wishing they could be with the Rancho Cienega family. Devin Auchel, Annenberg Radio News.
There are a surprisingly high number of cases where law enforcement have used lethal force against a suspect, only to later discover that that suspect was autistic. More than 2 years ago, LAPD officers shot and killed 27-year-old Stephen Washington, an unarmed autistic man. LA Chief Charlie Beck admitted last year that the officers made, quote, a serious tactical error when they shot him. I spoke with Emily Taylor of the Special Needs Network, an autism advocacy group based in Los Angeles, about what she calls the crisis of autism in the U.S.
There are 105,000 children in California with autism. And just to kind of put that in perspective, that's more children with autism in the state of California than there are total children living in the District of Columbia. It's enough children to fill the Staples Center six times over. And about a fourth of those live in Los Angeles. And then not to mention that about one in four of those children are in poverty. So we're looking at not only a large number of children in the area, but a large number of children who aren't receiving the intervention services they need.
So what can you explain to me, what are some of the shortcomings or missteps that law enforcement or even government officials, I guess you could say the fire department is a government body, that what are some of the common missteps they have with autism?
I think some of the biggest problems are the fact that children with autism often are nonverbal. And so if you respond to them and say, you know, what is your name, where are you from, they can't answer. And even if they want to, they can't. And that's assuming they even understand. The second issue is sensory issues. Children with autism often have very negative reactions to loud noises, busy environments, flashing lights even, are just very difficult and cause kind of these sensory nervous shutdowns. So when a flashing light of a police car or a fire truck comes by and then someone, you know, shouts commands at them, It has the exact opposite reaction as you'd expect on a normal person.
Yes, but police would be hard-pressed to decipher whether or not a child has autism before they, say, engage with them, correct?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very difficult situation, and I certainly would not want to be in their shoes, especially when there's, you know, a threat of violence on the line. But
what is something they can do? How can they address that issue in a productive manner?
Becoming familiar with how to read the body language of kids, and I think especially, you know, special needs kids, these symposiums, we offer training, there's like role-playing and interaction, and just, you know, they sit down and just have lunch with a child with special needs. And most people, you wouldn't think to, you know, just have that time with them, but you learn the symptoms, you learn kind of what to look for, certain behaviors, like inability to make eye contact, flapping, rocking, these kind of triggers that if you didn't know what to look for, you wouldn't be like, ah, that's a sign of a developmental disability.
Earlier you mentioned that one in four children in California that have autism live in poverty. And I'm curious, what role does race play in those statistics, specifically here in Los Angeles?
We have a campaign called Equality for Our Kids, which is a more political action campaign, which uses those parent advocates to rally around a cause, this cause being the equal distribution of resources by race specifically. The regional centers currently spend about $11,000 per child with autism for services for white children, and about $6,000 for resources for autism with children who are African-American, and $7,000 for children who are Latino. So the discrepancy there is obviously very telling, and it causes very tangible results.
That was Emily Taylor of the Special Needs Network. A judge ruled today that a lawsuit over a cupcake wrapper can go to trial. Sherry Mersola, owner of Moon Cherie, is suing a former shareholder and director, Teresa DeLiberto, for stealing her idea for decorative cupcake holders. After resigning from the company in 2010, DeLiberto allegedly used information from her former employer to advance her own cupcake company, Cupcake Cuties. Mersola is asking for unspecified damages and wants a court order to destroy all wrappers with the name Cupcake Cuties. Jackson Joe is a mom-and-pop breakfast place in South L.A. Since the restaurant's opening a year ago, they've attracted both students and a good portion of the community. Our reporter Heather Ritchie visited the restaurant to see what sets this place apart from the others.
Simra, Marina, Karen.
On the corner of Figueroa and Adams is a little breakfast place tucked away in a shopping center. If you were just driving by, you probably wouldn't even notice it. Jackson Joe was started by Vianney and Mark Bennors, a husband and wife duo who came up with the idea on a whim.
We were tired of the life we were living and just wanted to do something very different. I mean, just completely out of the box, and this was it.
Both former USC students, the Bennorses have lived a good portion of their life in South L.A. When they decided to open a restaurant, they knew this area was its future home.
We've just always found ourselves in this area somehow, and you know, where most people would probably be intimidated and be like, "Oh, are you crazy?" And we did get that.
The Bennorses designed and built it from the ground up. They made sure to hire many of the locals, some of which have been there since the very beginning.
I mean, one of them, when I was building, I met him. You know, I was building the restaurant. He came by and talked to me, and I said, "Yeah, come back." And he kept coming back and talking to me.
Jackson Joe doesn't have any USC memorabilia because they want to show the community that they matter too. Mark says that while USC is prominent, the locals were here first, and hopes Jackson Joe brings different types of people together for one common goal: breakfast.
People were saying we so needed this around here, and it's a place I can bring my kids and my family, and we can come eat breakfast, you know, and that's a good feeling.
Can I get the loaded hash browns with no meat, please?
Hash, no meat. And how would you like to exit that?
Travis Williams has been a waiter there from the start and admires the way the owners try to give back to the community.
I love the Bednors family. They're pretty amazing. They inspire me. Like, they opened up this restaurant, like, with the hopes of it becoming what it is now.
There's usually an hour and a half wait on the weekends. Some customers complain the wait is too long for food and the prices can be a tad overpriced. Ochanya Oga lives in the area and has been coming here since it first opened.
The food's really good, and it's a nice, chill atmosphere, and it's always just really nice to come here on a Saturday morning and just catch up with friends.
And while customers dine on food, a portion of their money usually goes towards a local or national charity the Bennorses are sponsoring at the time.
It's not so much how much we take in, it's how much we put out, and that's been the key to Jackson Joe. It's like, if we can help people out, we do.
As of now, the Bennorses have plans to expand, like a food truck or a takeout joint. But they want to make sure they keep the essence of Jackson Joe and not make it like a cafeteria.
Is that going to be all for you guys?
Heather Ritchie, Annenberg Radio News.
Actor Lane Garrison was charged today with a misdemeanor count of battery for allegedly hitting his ex-girlfriend. The 31-year-old former Prison Break cast member was arrested on Sunday. He's accused of striking Ashley Mattingly the day before while leaving an apartment elevator. Garrison is on parole for a guilty plea to vehicular manslaughter from 2007. The drunk driving crash killed a 17-year-old Beverly Hills high school student. And now we check in with Nuha Abu-Jabber to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Nuha?
Thanks, Ben. USC's offensive tackle Matt Khalil is expected to be one of the top picks in tonight's NFL draft. And Rupert Murdoch apologized in court today. Find out what the 81-year-old has to say about the phone hacking scandal. And finally, former Liberian president and warlord Charles Taylor was found guilty. This and a lot more on ATVN tonight.
Nuha, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for this Thursday and for the semester. I'd like to give a big shout out to our Thursday staff: Lucas Alexander, Nick Edmonds, Rosalie Murphy, Heather Ritchie, Melissa Runnels, and Conrad Wilton. Our production associate is Madeline Lindsay. Esther Kang is our producer. Emily Frost, our executive producer. A very big and special thank you to our technical guru, Billy Higgins, who keeps Annenberg Radio News afloat. And last but certainly not least, Willa Seidenberg, our director. From all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb. Thank you, and as always, take care.